From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. He's traveled to Antarctica twice. His children worry about climate change, and he says his faith compels him to act. Meet former Republican Congressman Bob Inglis, possibly the best hope to fight climate denial in the GOP.
My party will either get with the future or it'll get gone.
Also today, we'll talk about the Celtics playoff run with Bill Littlefield.
Right into the hands of Isaiah Thomas. Thomas down the lane, glides in and scores.
And who keeps track of all the art in Tuscany's churches? It's not an Italian minister, nor a dedicated art historian. Meet Brother David, the Franciscan friar.
We possess it, we use it, we pray with it, we present it to people. When people come, we share this beauty.
And he's sharing it with the MFA. Find out why next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Bob Inglis was a conservative Republican congressman from South Carolina when his son, who had just turned 18, told him, "Dad, I'll vote for you, but you've got to clean up your act on the environment." Inglis says he used to believe climate change was the business of the other tribe, but that conversation with his son was the beginning of what he calls a metamorphosis in his thinking on climate change. Now, Inglis makes it his work to put forward the conservative case for climate change. He won a John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award for his work on climate and energy in 2015, and he'll be speaking about opportunities for Republican leadership on climate change tonight at the Harvard Club of Boston. But he joins us now in our studios. Congressman Inglis, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
So I want to talk about your metamorphosis in just a second, but I just want to start right here, sort of at the heart of where we find ourselves today regarding the GOP and climate. Because back in 2015, you told Slate that your most positive scenario for near-term action on the climate was a Republican president in 2016, which we got. But we also got several of the most powerful people in government right now, including the president and then Vice President Pence, White House Advisor Steve Bannon, and the head of the EPA all expressing doubt, to put it lightly, about climate change. So what's your reaction to where we find ourselves regarding your party?
Yeah, funny thing happened on the way the election, huh? It wasn't quite the way that we envisioned that happening. Well, you know, I think that the hope is that that somebody like Rex Tillerson would be more heard than someone like, say, Scott Pruitt. Because Rex Tillerson, while he was at CEO of ExxonMobil, was advocating for what we are educating about, which is internalizing negative externalities, attaching all the cost to all the fuels, eliminating the subsidies, and then watching the free enterprise system solve this challenge.
Yeah.
And so we can hope that he can be heard. But you're right. The deck has been stacked against us. There's no doubt about that. But it will, I think, be a passing phenomenon that we will see populism burn out and conservatism refined as part of that fire.
Okay, so tell me more about why you're optimistic about it. Because, I mean, President Trump called climate change a Chinese hoax. Scott Pruitt, EPA administrator, says he doesn't think human activities at all are contributing to increasing carbon levels in the environment. I mean, we didn't just get here overnight because of a populist spasm in the electorate. I mean, what's really at the heart of so much climate denial in the GOP? What's driving that?
I think it's mostly what psychiatrists would call solution aversion. It's that the solutions that have been proposed have seemed to have been larger governments, involve larger governments, the growth of government through, for example, the Clean Power Plan, which is a regulatory answer. Before that, it was cap and tax, as it was branded by conservatives. And so both of those solutions involved a larger government footprint. And so what we live to do at republicen.org is to show that actually there's a very small government approach here. It's simply to have the government as the honest cop on the beat that says all cost in, all subsidies removed, now compete.
Okay.
And that's completely consistent with what conservatives believe. So if we can show that solution that's consistent with belief, then the need to resort to basically disputation of the science goes away, because now you got a solution that fits with your values. You don't have to doubt the existence of the problem.
But you see where the struggle, like I have to say my personal intellectual struggle with this is that like why resort to complete denialism? And this is, you know, again, it's not just this election cycle. This has been going on for, I don't know, 20 years. If it's just the solution that you don't like. I mean, denial is an extreme position to take.
Right.
There's no negotiation with denial.
Well, yeah. Isn't it true, though, that it happened really only in 2008 did this begin happening? So it's been since 2008. Because in early 2008, Newt Gingrich was on the couch with Nancy Pelosi, literally on a couch. You can see them on YouTube. We don't agree with them on much, do we, Newt? No, but we do agree that climate change is real, Nancy. And so that was the ad in early 2008. By the end of 2008, Newt Gingrich had flipped his position. So had John Boehner. So had Mitt Romney. And so it had to do with the Great Recession threatening us and causing us to basically distrust any further action and focus just on the immediacy of this month's mortgage payment, this month's paycheck, and not on the longer term things of things like climate change, what seemed longer term.
Yeah. So, I promise I'm going to get to your personal story because I think it's very illustrative, but you're here to help us understand how we got here. And I mean, the Great Recession, yes. I mean, it refocused everybody on immediate economic catastrophe that we were facing. But I still don't quite understand why certain very influential parts of the GOP resorted to climate denial. I mean, there were other things going on, right? Like a flood of media and spurious studies that went out there and said that were funded by various groups that were designed to refute the giant scientific basis of climate change. And I just feel like there was a lot going on beyond the recession. But let me ask you, this is you said you're looking for, or that fellow conservatives are looking for conservative solutions to this. And this is the other thing. Why is that so hard to find? Because I feel like America has proven that conservative solutions to these environmental problems work. I mean, for acid rain, for example, we had cap and trade.
Correct.
And that's a market-based solution. The government just put the cap on, but it was up to the market to figure out how to do the trading.
Right.
Not complicated. I mean, why can't that idea fly now for a carbon?
Well, of course, it did work very well with acid rain. Reason being, there were very few producers of the stuff that was creating the problem. And so you could get them in a room about this size and tell them now you're capped, trade underneath that cap. Of course, the challenge in climate change is different. 7 billion point sources, literally, and then all kinds of things that support those 7 billion lives create CO2, and so it's much more susceptible, we think, to a price signal solution than to any kind of cap and trade system, or than to a regulatory solution. And so, for conservatives among us, we're able to show them, for example, a clip of Dr. Milton Friedman on the Phil Donahue show saying, how do you deal with pollution? And Dr. Friedman says, well, you tax it, of course. If we can show that to conservatives, we think they'll remember who Milton Friedman was. Of course, when you're talking to populists, they don't know or care who Milton Friedman was. But to those of us who have spent a long time in conservatism, we know who he was, and we know how important his thinking was to forming credible conservatism. Now, of course, I'm speaking here in high-octane conservative terms, right? This is what we go to our tribe and speak about.
Yeah.
It's also true, though, that there are many progressives who would embrace this concept. Chief among them, I suppose, is Al Gore, who's been for what we're talking about for about 30 years.
Yeah. But the problem is that anytime you talk about starting to price carbon, one side or the other is going to call it a tax, and then it becomes this, you know, hot political potato. And the conversation seems to stop once we frame it as a carbon tax.
Right. It does so far.
Yeah.
But We go ahead and admit it's a tax, sure enough, because otherwise we don't want to hide it in fee language or any kind of obstructing kind of words that make it so we're trying to hide the ball. No, it is a tax we're talking about. But it is a tax that has two important aspects to it. One, is it paired with a reduction in existing taxes or with a dividend of all the money back so there's no growth of the government here? That's the revenue neutrality part.
Right.
And then second, it's a tax that's imposed on imports as if they had been made here. So that it basically, after China loses their challenge of that in the World Trade Organization, they follow suit and the whole world follows American leadership to impose a worldwide price on carbon dioxide without any agreement. Just a bold move by the United States and using the power of our marketplace. That's the border adjustment aspect of this. So when you put the compound adjective revenue neutral and border adjustable in front of the words carbon tax, it becomes somewhat more attractive. But you're right, it is still a carbon tax. But if we're grown-ups here, we can have a conversation that says, yeah, it's a tax. But it's paired with a dollar-for-dollar reduction in other taxes.
Yeah.
Taxes that punish income. And if so we go listen to great economists like Greg Mankiw at Harvard, founding member of the Pigou Club, he would tell us that what Pigou told us long ago, and that is you tax things you want less of and you untax things you want more of. Mm-hmm. We want less emissions? Tax them. We want more income? Untax it.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of people listening might say, absolutely, you know, we need grown-ups at the table to have this conversation. But perhaps given some of the rhetoric coming from the highest levels of the administration right now about climate change, they don't have confidence that there are grown-ups at the table to have this conversation. But let me get the story of your metamorphosis, because I have to say, I mean, it's remarkable given the context that we find ourselves in about climate. What was your attitude before about climate change, before your son came to you that fateful day and said, you got to clean up your act here?
Well, for 6 years, I said climate change is nonsense. I didn't know anything about it except that Al Gore was for it.
And that was enough.
That was enough. And I admit it's ignorant. But you know, I represented the reddest district, the reddest state in the nation. And being sent to Congress all of a sudden, as I was, I'd never been in office before, and there I was in Congress. Some things you have to just decide based on who's on the other side, you know, and so that's what I did on climate change. But then I was out 6 years doing commercial real estate law again in Greenville, South Carolina, and that's when my son came to me as I was running yet again for the House in 2004 after 6 years out. And so that was a step, first step. And then the second step was going to Antarctica with the Science Committee and seeing the evidence there in the ice core drillings.
You went to Antarctica twice.
Yeah, and then that next trip was the third step in the metamorphosis, which was a stopover at the Great Barrier Reef, snorkeling with an Aussie climate scientist named Scott Herron, and I could tell, shared my worldview. I could see that he was worshiping God in what he was showing me. And so later we talked and he told me about conservation changes he's making in his life to love God and love people. And I wanted to be like Scott, loving God and loving people. So I came home and introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009 as an alternative to cap and trade.
You found yourself out of office in 2010.
note to self, do not introduce carbon tax in midst of Great Recession in reddest district and reddest state of nation. It won't go well for you. It didn't go well at all. I'd, by the way, commit some other heresies, too, against Republican orthodoxy at that time, like being for comprehensive immigration reform and voting for TARP and voting against the troop surge out of conservative concerns about nation building in Iraq. But my most enduring heresy was just saying climate change is real. Let's do something about it.
You sound downright sensible here in your heresies. But so the reason why I'm glad to hear this story is the stakes are so high. I mean the way you talk about faith and looking at the natural world and that this is what we've been given, right? And we've got to protect it. I mean, like many people see it that way. And yet they also see the United States currently acting. We're going to pull. The president has said he wants to pull out of the Paris Climate Accords. He misleads coal workers and tells them that they're going to have their jobs back when, in truth, the coal industry is in long-term decline.
Right.
partially because of natural gas, I know. But I mean, there's just all this stuff going on with American leadership that's counter to what you're talking about changing their understanding of climate. Short of having all of their children go to them and say, you better change your act on climate, or otherwise I'm not going to vote for you. Short of taking the entire House of Representatives down to McMurdo Station in Antarctica, how can we get attitudes to change faster?
Well, it is. You're on the last word is a key word. Is faster. Is we've got to do this fast, right? And the climate scientists listening to us right now are saying, really fast, get this done fast. And so, I think that what we can't do those things you're just mentioning. We can't take everybody to McMurdo. Obviously, they won't go. It's a long trip, and it's a cold place. And who wants to go there? You know, but I do. But not a lot of people do. But I think what it takes really is just going to them with credible messengers and affirming their truth. This is on in my tribe. Go to them. Actually, go to them. Sit with them, with credible messengers. In other words, people that share their values and affirm the truth of the tribe, that there is a free enterprise answer available to us here.
I mean, is Speaker Ryan listening to you, for example?
Well, I know this, that Paul knows that what we're talking about at RepublicEN.org is the right answer to this challenge. I know that. The problem for us is the same problem for Paul, is that he's got activists in his district who would call him what they've called our folks in his district. They say that the college students that are helping us are communist, that they are red on the outside, green on the outside, they're watermelons, green on the outside, communist red on the inside. And that's who Paul and other members of Congress are afraid of, is the activist within their own party. This happens on the left too,
yeah.
But on the right, it's the activist who will destroy someone in a primary. And that's where we've got to sort of flood this process with more reasonable people who say, listen, to these activists who are listening to sources that are really not reputable, is either help them to see the light and to come to understand that this is a real challenge with a real answer in free enterprise, or figure out a way to marginalize them so that they are no longer the determining factor in someone like Paul Ryan's thinking. But if you're in office today, what you're mostly worried about is being taken out in a primary. And so that's what we've got to do, is we've got to reach into our conservative tribe and convince them that we got an answer. Yes, we do. We got an answer. How about you? You know, and cheer that to the progressives on the other side. Now, after we complete that cheer, I think that progressives may well cheer back to us, we got the same answer. Yes, we do. And so let's lead. Let's get this done.
I think this is the exact issue in which a bipartisan solution is waiting. It's just waiting for action, right?
Without a doubt.
Well, former Congressman Bob Inglis, he was a congressman in South Carolina's 4th from 1993 to 1999, and again from 2005 to that fateful re-election attempt in 2010. He's executive director of Republican EN, a group that advocates free market solutions to climate change. He's going to be speaking about that tonight at the Harvard Club of Boston. Congressman Inglis, thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure to have you here.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is time for sports with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Meghna.
You want to start talking about baseball and the Red Sox? Is that a good place to start for today?
Good time to talk about baseball, even though it feels more like November than April right now.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they were set to open up a series with the Yankees yesterday, but the game was postponed due to rain. It would have been the two teams' first meeting of the year. But things don't seem to have the same feeling this year. Does anyone actually, wait, other than Anthony Brooks, does anyone actually still care about the Sox-Yankees rivalry?
How long have you been in Boston?
Oh, my God.
Not long enough.
No, well, why?
Yankees-Red Sox will always matter to a considerable portion of the Boston fan base.
Forever.
Without any doubt. You know, there are people who say, I don't care if the Red Sox finish next to last in the division as long as the Yankees finish last. And that probably will never change. It's just the way a lot of people feel.
Okay. Well, so let's move on then to other things that are happening within the Red Sox. And the answer to your question is I've been in Boston for 19 years.
That should
now.
Be long enough.
That's long enough.
Yeah,
I should know
absolutely.
Better. Well, Red Sox second baseman Dustin Pedroia was involved in this incident with Orioles third baseman Manny Machado on Friday. Machado had slid into, for people who don't remember, including me, Machado had slid into second, spiking Pedroia in the process. And then on Sunday, Sox pitcher Matt Barnes threw a fastball that seemed to be meant for Machado's head. But it's Dustin Pedroia's response that everyone's been talking about because he actually apologized to Machado. What do you make of that?
Well, I hope what that was about was Dustin Pedroia recognizing that sometimes these incidents get blown up into truly dangerous circumstances. And people forget sometimes how dangerous baseball can be. Everybody knows that the contact sports can do real damage to people. But that baseball is coming at the batter's head in excess of 95 miles an hour sometimes. And you throw a pitch behind somebody's head, their first impulse is to go back to get out of the way of something heading, but they're going to get hit in the head. And that's no joke. And I mean, you go back all the way to Tony Conigliaro in Boston fans' memory. It's no joke when you get hit in the head with a baseball. Mm. So maybe Pedroia was just trying to sort of calm things down and say, all right, let's just let this be where it is and not go any further.
Yeah, I mean, put that way, it sounds like a good thing that he did.
I'm trying to give him every bit of the benefit of the doubt, and, you know, that's... seems fair.
Okay, good. Well, let's move on and talk a little bit about basketball here because the Celtics, man, they looked like they were getting ready to possibly face some serious embarrassment this postseason.
Or at least play some golf.
That's true. Because they'd entered the playoffs as number one, but then they go down for the first two games of the series. They did scratch back. They're now tied, beating the Bulls twice and in Chicago, I should point out. So are they back in control of this series?
Well, I think they may be. Chicago's missing their point guard, a young gentleman named Rondo, with whom Boston fans are certainly familiar.
Yep.
And no team is helped when their point guard is out of action. And Boston, to be fair, if you look at the season, they, like all basketball teams, including the Cleveland Cavaliers, including the Golden State Warriors, from time to time hit patches where nobody can quite figure out why they aren't playing a little better than they are. And I think by the fact that they beat Chicago the last two, they probably look ready to at least get out of this round and do some damage further on.
Well, so speaking of point guards, let's talk for a second about Isaiah Thomas for the Celts, because the day before the playoffs started, he faces horrible tragedy. His sister died in a car crash.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when your family is just faced with something like that, it's natural to wonder if he could still play at the level he's been playing at this season while mourning the loss of his sister. So we have a little bit of tape here from Isaiah Thomas talking about the support he's received from the Celtics.
They've been everything. This organization is the best organization there is, from the people who work in the Garden to the players, the coaches, everybody who's a part of the Celtics.
Talk to me a little bit about this and Isaiah.
It's fantastic to hear him say that. It's great that the Celtics have encouraged him. And it makes me sort of think about how players respond in these sort of situations. Some of them are able to exhibit this astonishing level of concentration. They're able to say, well, my sister would have wanted me to play as well as I possibly can tonight, or my father, my mother. I don't know how many people remember the season Wade Boggs was playing here when his mother died. And he was able to play at an incredibly high level for the entire season. And then the last day of the season, there were photographs of him broken down in tears in the dugout because he'd put it all off. Until there was no more baseball to be played, and then he was completely overwhelmed by it. And I don't know how some of these guys are constituted in such a way that that's what they can do. But, you'll always hear debates about should they have been able to do it? What's the matter with this guy that he's able to do this? And I'm not a psychiatrist and a psychologist, and I would never venture a guess into these sorts of things.
I feel that these are moments, and sports quite often does this, where the human eventually catches up with the superhuman.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game. You can hear him every Saturday on WBUR at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. And, of course, on Wednesdays right here on Radio Boston. Bill, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Pleasure for me, too, Meghna.
The Trump administration announced its vision for a revamped U.S. tax code today. Here's Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin outlining the plan earlier this afternoon.
The economic plan under Trump will grow the economy and will create massive amounts of revenues, trillions of dollars in additional revenues.
Well, it could also create trillions of dollars to the deficit. The plan calls for reducing the number of individual income tax brackets down to 3, slashing the corporate tax rate to 15%, eliminating the estate tax and others. But it also calls for doubling the standard deduction, which would essentially eliminate taxes on the first $24,000 a couple earns. Now, you've probably heard of that quotation oft attributed to the great Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. Taxes are what we pay for a civilized society. So what version of a civilized society do we see in this Trump tax plan? Joining us now with his thoughts is Richard Parker. He is an economist at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He's also former president of the liberal group Americans for Democratic Action. Richard Parker, welcome to Radio Boston.
Nice to be with you.
So can you give us your first reactions to these broad outlines that the Trump administration has provided today? It's just a one-page glimpse into their tax plan, but your first thoughts.
Sure. It's surprisingly like Republican orthodox tax policy since the Reagan administration. This is basically the third iteration of one form or another of what's called supply-side economics. The central argument is that we're overtaxed, corporations are overtaxed, the wealthy are overtaxed, but so are the rest of us. And if taxes are dramatically reduced, it will set off an explosion of growth and investment that will flow back not just to the corporations and wealthy, but to the rest of us. That's the argument. It was tried in the 1980s, and it was tried again in the aughts by George W. Bush. And now we're in 2017 about to go through to home plate for a third round of pitching this story.
So, I mean, in your view, is that the kind of tax plan that best supports the civilized society that we envision for America?
Well, I'll try to maintain a neutral scholar's hat for a moment. A couple of things, one of which is, does this kind of tax policy, in fact, grow the economy dramatically better than other tax policies? We have a lot of data on that, and the answer is, I think, pretty conclusively no. In fact, the United States had much better growth rates in the 50s and 60s when the top marginal rates on individuals were over 90% and corporations paid as much as 2 to 3 times as much in taxes as they do today. Now, that may sound counterintuitive, but it is also about how hard you want to work for what you get. I suppose, you know, for those hedge fund managers who made $1, 2, or 3 billion last year, the question is, would they work hard if they were only getting $500 million? My suspicion is almost all of them are type A personalities who would love to make the $500 million in some ways as much as they're delighted to make the $1 or 2 billion.
Yeah, I think Warren Buffett himself, I mean, he's obviously famously for a very aggressive estate tax, but he said that he's never made a business decision, nor anyone that he knows, that has been swayed by the intricacies of the U.S. tax code.
Right. I mean, some corporations have, and, you know, there's an industry of consultants, accountants, and lawyers who do nothing but direct or channel investment decisions based on exactly that. We
right.
got that in the 1980s when, in fact, we wildly overbuilt the commercial real estate market in the United States. And if you've been reading in recent weeks, we've got a tremendous problem in commercial real estate, and it's a legacy of enormous, enormous overbuilding of commercial real estate because of the restructuring of American taxes and the write-offs of investment in commercial real estate. We basically doubled the total square footage of commercial real estate in the United States in a little more than a decade.
So to focus a little bit more on the centerpiece of this tax plan, again, the Trump administration basically put out a page or so, so many, many details yet to be filled in. But reducing the corporate tax rate to 15%, I mean, down from its statutory rate of 35%, and I say that specifically because in reality, the effective rate is not 35% in the United States for all the reasons why you just mentioned. But there continues to be this notion that it would spur business. It would spur growth. I mean, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin today just said he thinks that this one thing could spur trillions of dollars of growth to the U.S. economy. And you say,
well,
you
say, I mean, I want to be patient and I want to be complimentary of Secretary Mnuchin. And I believe that he's owed a hearing like the president on this. But they're going to have to produce some data that would conclusively show that that's true. And as I said, we have prior examples of exactly this kind of tax policy. And any reputable economist or tax specialist can sit down with the press, sit down with the Congress and tell them, comparatively, what was achieved by doing this particular kind of massive supply-side tax cutting. As I said just a moment ago, it doesn't produce the growth that has been promised. The more important thing for many Americans today is that it's directly associated with a constantly growing income inequality.
Right.
Before supply-side economics started, the top 1% had about 8% of the total income of all households. It's now got somewhere between a quarter and 22-24%, basically almost has tripled its share of total income in the United States. So there's a distributional problem if you consider inequality upwards a problem. And of course, that's probably not as neutral as I should be because I'm more concerned about it than downward shifts of. The other is that it constantly adds to the debt.
Right. Yeah.
No Republican has been able to manage a balanced budget for one single year since 1958. The last president in the Republican Party to balance a federal budget was Dwight David Eisenhower. Hmm. And I think that all of us ought to pause when you think that the federal debt is right now nudging up on $20 trillion. And we're passing on to a generation who didn't ask for it a burden of repayment that is going to make the idea that we need these kinds of stimulus in order to provoke a few within the society to do well for us all.
Well,
to lead to revolt. I mean, I'm just terribly concerned about the misdirection of the fundamental arguments in this policy.
So just I'm seeing here that the Tax Policy Center says that this latest tax plan from President Trump or the Trump administration would cost $4 trillion over the next 10 years. So potentially adding that much
I've seen those numbers. It could go higher depending on whether or not a couple of additional things are pushed through. $4 trillion is the low ball number.
Right. So let me ask you, I think it's fairly clear to listeners where your sympathies lie. But
With a fair and honest tax plan.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, why is it regarding supply-side dogma, supply-side orthodoxy, why do you think that has held such powerful sway amongst members of the, members of the federal government for so long? I mean, especially given the evidence that you point to that shows that it may not spur economic growth as much as it's hoped to or claimed to.
Let's see. I would probably say honest but uninformed belief, greed, and stupidity. I think those are the three factors. I don't describe all three of them uniformly to all advocates, but I think that to some measure or another, those things can be distributed fairly well across the advocate platform that's been advanced. Again, I would be glad to stand up with Grover Norquist or Paul Ryan or Secretary Mnuchin and go over the data of the last 50 to 70 years of American tax policy history, American growth, American income distribution, and American indebtedness, and see what the majority of Americans believe at the end of that discussion.
Hmm. You know, the Trump plan, or the broadest outlines of it revealed today, on the one hand, seek to eliminate the estate tax altogether, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, mm-hmm. talk about eliminating all sorts of other deductions which may have been particularly beneficial to higher income workers. I mean, what do you think about that, about simplifying the tax code by eliminating those deductions? Is that a possible way to begin to address the inequities that are in the tax code?
Don't think of it as the estate tax, or as the Republicans prefer, the death tax. They love that phrase, the death tax, that grew out of polling that they did in the 1990s as part of the Contract with America. Think of it instead as the Donald Trump's children's free money tax. Because in essence, you're saying to a country that believes that there is a reward to hard work, that there's an even greater reward to your choice of parents. And that seems to me to be a peculiar form of reasoning, and I do think that it's deeply detached from hard work, because I don't think any of us, as eggs or spermatozoa, actually made choices that we could call informed about who our parents would be.
Yeah. You know, on the other hand, though, at the very beginning of this conversation, I mentioned that the Trump plan does propose to double that standard deduction. Okay, so would that make a significant difference to people?
Of course it'll make a significant difference to some people, but nearly half of Americans don't pay income tax now. What you have to understand is that the sources of funding for the federal government have changed dramatically over the last 50 years. The segment of funding for the government that has grown most rapidly are payroll and associated payroll taxes. And those are profoundly regressive in the sense that they're uniform. And in the case of Social Security, they're a flat tax up to about $120,000, and then they drop to zero. Let me explain for your listeners what I mean, which is that if I'm earning $30,000 and the Social Security tax is, let's call it for simplicity's sake, 10%, mm-hmm. I pay out $3,000.
Yeah.
If I pay $100,000, I pay $10,000. But after that, I still pay no more than $10,000.
Yeah.
So if I make a million, I'm still paying $10,000. If I make a million and I pay $10,000 and you make $30,000 and pay $3,000, which of us is paying higher taxes?
Right.
That's where the growth in taxes has come. The other place in which taxes have fallen are corporate taxes.
Right. And I'm sorry to have to cut you off there, Mr. Parker, but we're just out of time. Richard Parker, he's economist at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, delight, as always. Always love to talk taxes with you.
Hopefully we'll do it again soon. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. About 24 fantastic paintings by famed Renaissance artist Sandro Botticelli are now on display at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts in an exhibit called Botticelli and the Search for the Divine. It's believed to be the largest exhibit of Botticelli's work in the United States. Well, we've got a story about the person who brought one of those paintings to town. His name is Brother David. He's a Franciscan friar, and he had the unusual job of accompanying Botticelli's St. Augustine in his study from its usual spot in the Church of Ognissanti in Florence all the way to Boston. On a recent trip to Florence, former WBUR producer Anna Benstead visited Brother David to find out why this unassuming friar is charged with keeping tabs on thousands of works of art tucked away in churches all over Tuscany.
Some of the churches are quite out of the way, and you have to reach them by foot, sometimes up steep hills, ignoring inviting cafes and restaurants because you want to get to the church before it closes. Well, I made it to the top of the hill. There's the most amazing view of Florence, with its famous Renaissance cathedral, the Duomo, imposing down there in the Arno Valley below. The doors of the church here at San Francesco are open and I can go in to see some famous paintings. There's a Neri de Bici, but I'm not here just to see the art, but to meet one of the residents of the monastery.
Pronto? Ah, pronto, sono qui per Fra David.
Ho capito, ora lo chiamo allora.
Grazie.
I'm led through frescoed corridors and across sun-filled cloisters into the small refectory where the friars take their meals. This could be the room of a rustic trattoria with its wooden tables and glorious views over the Tuscan hills, except for the row of hooks on a wall, upon which hang half a dozen brown cloth habits for friars. Eventually, my host at San Francesco, Brother David, appears.
Oh. Salve!
Excuse me.
He looks every bit the figure of a friar, with a full dark beard too. But he's a little worried that he's late and not wearing one of the habits.
It's not a problem if I don't wear my habit, no?
No, that, luckily it's radio. It's radio, you're okay.
Brother David explains that he doesn't always wear the distinctive brown habit of a friar, as he's often out of the monastery, at his office in Florence. From there, he oversees the thousands of pieces of art in Tuscany's Franciscan churches. What's going out on loan, what's getting restored, who unlocks the church doors for art-loving visitors. Is he then trained as an art historian?
No. I'm very curious about it. I study every time I have the possibility to do it. But my role is more, let us say, technical. My job, the Tuscany region, is to be the secretary of the province. The secretary of the province is the person in charge for the Franciscan order to coordinate with the ministries.
And before that, did you have involvement with the art? Was this something that they just sprung on you?
Yes, I was always involved in these kind of things because most of the convents we live in, they are cultural heritage. So when we live in a place, we have to know what are our possessions. We have to do it because it's a part of our life.
Now, you live in the convent here.
Yeah.
Can I say monastery?
Normally, yeah, it's in English you say monastery.
Okay,
we would say convent, but I know that in English, convent is for nuns.
I thought I'd clear that up. So normally you live in the monastery, here, and you pray here, you go to church here, your life is here.
My life here, as the life of my brothers here, is quite simple, as all the Franciscan communities. We get up in the morning, we pray with the whole community. We have a little community of elder friars, and then every one of us has its own job. What is the liaison with the art? It's easily said. We possess it, we use it, we pray with it, we present it to people. When people come, we share this beauty.
The Franciscans might possess the art, but who actually owns all these precious paintings?
Historically, yes, they belong to the Franciscan order. But in fact, there's a little problem with Italian state, because after 1800, all the things belonging to the church became part of the national heritage, very simply.
But for practical purposes, the paintings are hanging in the churches, such as this one in San Francesco.
Exactly. And many times, some of the things belonging to the church, they were bought by private people who gave it again to the church.
See, so there's a sort of circular Italian affair going
on here. Exactly. Normal, yeah. This is typical Italian culture.
Brother David maintains his wonderfully good humour, whether talking of the past or the present. He tells me that while the art in their churches enriches the Franciscan order in many ways, the brothers don't have the riches to maintain their historic buildings, let alone the paintings.
We are mendicant orders, so we don't possess much money or things. So normally we try to find private individuals here, or foundations that are interested in arts or in cultural heritage to help us. We had a wonderful marriage last summer here. There was the daughter of the very well-known coffee company, Lavazza, the daughter. She got married in our church, and she wanted to restore a part of the ceiling. So she financed privately that kind of work. That's how we managed to maintain our heritage.
But there's still more to do.
There's still more to do, yeah. Half of the church has to be restored, yeah.
Have you asked Nespresso?
No, we asked for Lavazza again. We say in Italian, chi lascia la via vecchia per la via nuova sa quel che lascia, non sa quel che trova. So it's always safer to take the old path than the new one.
Well, I'll drink a nice cup of espresso to that.
Brother David says that lending out art for exhibitions, such as the one at the MFA, is an important way of looking after the paintings, a necessary complement to private philanthropy and modest state funding. The loans allow for restorations that otherwise would not get done. Sometimes a sort of bartering takes place, whereby conservation is carried out, if not of the actual painting on loan, of other works for which the order is responsible.
So my position is that of seeing where the work is going to, and to make contacts with people who see it, because we want to spread in a certain way arts, but we also want to find a way of collaborating with other institutions or people to restore things or something similar.
Time now to leave the monastery on the hill. A place of such cloistered peace and beauty that Albert Einstein was drawn here when he needed time for reflection. He occasionally played his violin in the church, or even, it's said, in the nearby woods. But Brother David wants to show me the Franciscan church in Florence, a few kilometres down the hill, where the Botticelli, bound for Boston, usually resides.
At the moment we are in the city center of Florence, in the heart of Florence, near the river Arno. It's one of the most beautiful spots in Florence. And this is one of the most beautiful churches in Florence, the Church of Ogni Santi.
Inside the church, Brother David and I sit on a pew almost as if at the feet of St. Augustine. We're looking at an exact copy of the painting. Botticelli's representation of St. Augustine is monumental. The white-haired saint, his gaze firmly upwards, is a large figure robed in red, seated at his desk in a study lined with weighty-looking tomes.
The painting was one of the most famous paintings of Botticelli, because it represents St. Augustine in his room where he studies, okay? But he's a bishop. What is also interesting in this play of colors, you can find the globe, okay? Because Renaissance theology puts together science and theology. That's to say that theologians are talking about reality, not about something that doesn't exist. And so this kind of a symbol inside a painting like this means that Catholic theology wants to speak with the science, okay?
So the spiritual world he's looking upwards is exactly. Meeting the temporal world,
exactly.
The real world.
Exactly, exactly.
How do you like it personally, the painting?
Oh, it's perhaps, from my opinion, it's one of the most beautiful.
And there's an added poignancy to that beauty because of the artist's connection to Ogni Santi. Not only did Botticelli live in the neighbourhood, he's buried in a small chapel of this very church. And it was a wealthy local family, the Vespucci, who commissioned the painting from the artist. You might recognise that name, Vespucci, as Amerigo Vespucci was the Italian explorer whose first name framed the great lands to which he journeyed around 1500. Typically, families like the Vespucci, who commissioned paintings in the Italian Renaissance, would have wanted a symbol of their patronage in the work, to prove not just their faith, but their power too. I spot a coat of arms, a shield. But what are those tiny dark dots on it?
Ah, with quelle vespe, con le api, the bees. Oh. The bees are represented inside the coat of arms. I'm not sure why.
Perhaps because the Vespucci family had a bit of a sting?
No, Vespa.
Oh, Vespa, yes.
Yes, because the surname means bee.
Oh, yes.
It comes from the animal.
Yeah.
Yeah. The coat of arms normally has to do something with the surname. So the Famiglia Vespucci comes from Italian Vespa,
And for a lot of people in America, Vespa will also mean one of those zippy little scooters.
Exactly. That's the meaning originally. Yeah, it means that. Yeah, it's a bzzz. Yeah.
So when it's people come to see the Botticelli St. Augustine in Boston, they can look for the bees.
Exactly. Above the head of St. Augustine.
That's Franciscan friar Brother David speaking with former WBUR producer Anna Benstead at the Church of Ogni Santi in Florence. Brother David brought Botticelli's St. Augustine in his study to a new exhibit at the MFA called Botticelli and the Search for the Divine. And by the way, Anna tells us that if you do go to the MFA exhibit and you look for those tiny things floating above St. Augustine's head, you're actually looking for wasps, as Vespae are wasps and not bees. We are fact-checking here until the very end. And this beautiful chanting you hear, these monks singing right now, they are from the San Francesco Monastery in Fiesole. The voice you hear most prominently, Brother David. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.